You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, welcome into MLB.com Extras as we take a trip around the American League East. I'm Tim McMaster, joined first by MLB.com Yankees reporter Brian Hoke. Let's get right into things because the Yankees have done a lot. They've taken care of a lot of issues early on in the offseason. So when you look at this roster, what's left to do between now and the start of spring training in just over a month?
Well, I think when you look at it, you'd love to add some kind of starting pitching depth. I mean, you went into the offseason and they said that was their top priority. They knew they had to get a second baseman. They were going to upgrade the bullpen if they could. And they did that, obviously, with Aroldis Chapman. That was the bullpen move, and Starlin Castro is going to be the second baseman. So you answered those questions, and you put Aaron Hicks in the outfield. He replaces Chris Young. That basically runs down the offseason right there. The one thing left to do is you had a rotation where not a single guy went over 170 innings last year. Nobody made 30 starts. There's some legitimate concerns there, and they've got seven guys, and you could go to spring training with what you have right now, but if you can add to that, I think you'd like to.
Now, are they more likely to sign a free agent or still maybe make a trade?
I think the trade market seems to be the way that Brian Cashman wants to go on this. There's definitely a pattern and a trend in what he's been doing and what he's been trying to do. Put it simply, they don't have the money right now. And I know that everybody kind of rolls their eyes and says, oh, yeah, the Yankees don't have the money. Well, they're waiting for these big contracts to expire. You've got Mark Teixeira and Carlos Beltran coming off the books. The year after that, you're going to have CeCe Sabathia and Alex Rodriguez. They're running out the clock on that. They're trying to pivot and get a little younger. You see that in the moves that they're making with the trades and everything they've done. But Cashman keeps bringing it up. If they were to go out and sign, say, David Price, who is obviously now off the market, but if they had done that, they were going to pay a 50% tax on top of every dollar they paid. So when you're talking about signing a guy for $30 million a year, you can start to see why Hal Steinbrenner has pulled back the checkbook and said, wait, find another way to do it. And that's what you see the Yankees doing with the trade market.
So then the question is, who gets traded? And is it still a chance of Brett Gardner being that guy?
I think there's still a chance. Until Gardner's in left field on opening day, I'm going to say there's a chance. And I know that Cashman has said that they'd prefer to keep Andrew Miller. That's their working plan. They want to have this super bullpen with Chapman and Miller and Dellin Betances, and that sounds wonderful. The one concern I'd have there is you're probably going to be looking at a potential suspension here for Chapman of some length. Nobody knows how long it's going to be, but I would not be shocked at all if Miller and or Dellin Betances have to stay for some period of time here and be the closer. So I think you have to stay ready for that idea. And that being said, I think you're one piece now that you can dangle and move. Other than Ivan Nova, who doesn't seem to be garnering much trade interest, is Brett Gardner. He's 32. You may have seen the best of him already. I think that he's probably peaked as a player. We'll see where he goes the next few years, but he's under contract the next 3 years, $39 million more on that deal. He's attractive. There's a reason the Yankees would want to keep him, but I could see why they want to move him too.
All right, let's get into the Chapman deal. Lots of levels of this. I think the first thing is the timing, because it seemed like this wasn't going to happen for any team until after Major League Baseball's investigation of the off-the-field stuff. But then it happens. The Yankees get it done early, and it seems like by doing that, they maybe got a discount on what they had to give up. But what kind of conversations did the Yankees have to have in the front office with ownership to be able to make a move like this for a guy that, let's be honest, has a lot of controversy surrounding him right now?
Yeah, I think there's absolutely a lot of conversations that had to happen there. I remember back in the winter meetings just talking to people around the game, and they were saying Chapman is toxic right now. No team can touch him. I mean, the stuff that was going on with him and the gunshots in the garage and domestic violence and Florida, it's all ugly. There's no way to spin it and say that that's a good thing. I mean, it's awful, but baseball is doing their due diligence on it. And look, he was going to come back and pitch somewhere. The Reds, if they had to go into the season with him, they could have done that. The deal with the Dodgers obviously fell through at the winter meetings, and that's when the Yankees jumped in there, and Brian Cashman said that the Yankees had been on Chapman over the last few years. They'd even tried to get him at the trade deadline. If you remember, there was a lot of talk about they were trying to upgrade the bullpen and get Craig Kimbrell. Well, behind the scenes, they were trying to get Chapman, too, it turns out. They couldn't do it at that time without giving up guys like Aaron Judge, Luis Severino, the guys that Cashman had made it clear they weren't going to trade. So when you come back and circle around here, obviously the price had dropped, knowing what we know now, and a four-player deal that the Yankees sent there, but they had to do some investigating. I'm sure they did their own looking into it the same way Major League Baseball and law enforcement are in Florida, but it was a tough decision, and I think that the Yankees know there could be some blowback from that. I think you've seen a little bit of that already. It's not a pretty thing. But you think back, and the Yankees have been known, they've given guys second chances in the past. I'm thinking about Darryl Strawberry and Dwight Gooden and Steve Howe. And I mean, I know we're going back here, but there have been guys with off-field problems who have come to the Yankees and regenerated their career and restored it. And you hope that Chapman can take advantage of that opportunity, because clearly, if you look at the package the Yankees gave to Cincinnati, his stock has fallen quite a bit, and you can't touch a guy who's been on four straight All-Star teams for that package.
All right, so obviously the Red Sox before the new year did plenty of their work as far as this season goes, looking ahead to 2016. So between now and when spring training gets started in a little over a month, hard to believe that, what is there left to do when Dave Dombrowski looks at this roster and looks at this team?
Yeah, I actually think Dave Dombrowski feels pretty good about his roster right now, and he'd be happy to go to spring training with this roster. A lot of people say, why don't you trade Hanley Ramirez? I think that's easier said than done with Hanley's contract, and he's not coming off a very good year. And also, the Red Sox kind of need his production, behind David Ortiz, and they need as much offense as you can get. So, I almost think that they think that, their best team would be one in which Hanley is hitting like he's capable of. So, I expect Hanley Ramirez to come to the spring training with this team in February.
It's weird how I think people's viewpoint of a team changes a little over time as the offseason goes by. When the Red Sox made the moves to get Kimbrell, to get Price, to bring in these players and quickly fill all these holes, what I was reading as far as the fan base goes was just excitement and here we go, we're ready to contend. And then the more time that goes by, people seem to start bringing up the question marks. Is Castillo going to be able to do it in the outfield? What about Hanley and Pablo? Is that just a natural thing that happens with fans? They can never be happy enough.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about Boston is, people aren't sugarcoating anything. They're always trying to find, whatever that weakness might be and try to, analyze it and hope they can build the perfect team. But, it's tough to build the perfect team. Dave Dombrowski has certainly made a nice start, toward building a playoff team with getting David Price and getting Kimbrell. And I think that Chris Young and Carson Smith also real nice additions to this team. And the team kind of finished strong last year with some of the young guys starting to stand out. But, you're always one. There's always going to be question marks in any season, and that's what makes a place like Boston, a lot of fun, because people are analyzing the Red Sox year-round, and it's only going to get there's only going to be more scrutiny once the Patriots playoff run ends, whenever that is.
Yeah, the Red Sox always hoping for those Super Bowl runs from the Patriots just to keep them going until spring training. All right, well, Wade Boggs is going to have his number retired for the Boston Red Sox, and I think some people would say, hey, this is about time. And then other people will say, wait, this is the guy that went to the Yankees. So what kind of a vibe have you been getting as far as this decision by the Red Sox to retire Wade Boggs as number 26?
Yeah, I think the first thing you said were, what took so long? I mean, Wade Boggs is a first ballot Hall of Famer who won five batting titles. And oh, by the way, all five of those batting titles were with the Boston Red Sox, not the New York Yankees. He's never a Hall of Fame player without playing for the Red Sox and without that swing that he tailored perfectly for Fenway Park, playing racquetball with that left field wall out there for so many years. So, yeah, I just think that, for whatever reason, maybe they were a little wary of it before because he did leave for the Yankees. But, as Wade himself has explained a lot in recent weeks, it wasn't really his choice. The Red Sox have made an offer to him to be a Red Sox for life. And Jean Yawkey made him that offer. And then she passed away a few months after that, and the offer was pulled off the table and never really revisited. And the Red Sox decided to go in another direction. So at that point, as often happens when a Red Sox player doesn't get an offer from the team for free agency, the Yankees, so the next team to step in That's what happened. In Wade's case, he happened to win a championship with that team, and that's just the way. But, you know, that's ancient history now, and it's time to appreciate what Wade Boggs did. The guy was a hitting machine, best pure hitter in the American League for most of his time in Boston, so I think it's a fitting tribute that his number will be retired on May 26th, matching his uniform number of 26.
Yeah, I think when he not only went to the Yankees, you know, but he did win the championship. And I think for a long time, people just saw him on the back of that horse at Yankee Stadium after winning the title. But eventually that goes away. And I think it's important what you said. I mean, when you look at what he did in his career, he did most of it in Boston, and certainly great to be remembered. And it's neat how the Red Sox in recent years have kind of put bygones behind them. Carlton Fisk. They put that kind of behind them and put his number up there, and now Wade Boggs as well. You said it, he's a first ballot Hall of Famer, which brings us to the discussion of the 2016 Hall of Fame class, because it's that week in baseball. Once you get past the new year, it's time to think Hall of Fame. And the Red Sox, a few players on the ballot, nobody that's going to get in the Hall of Fame for 2016, but Curt Schilling, 39.2% in 2015. And that's expected to jump here in 2016. Schilling's still with plenty of time to get in the hall. Do you think he's a guy that gradually climbs that mountain and gets to the needed 75% to get into Cooperstown?
Yeah, I absolutely think that Curt Schilling is going to be in the Hall of Fame one day, you know, maybe in the next 3-4 years. I think what hurt him the last couple of years was just, you know, that you had the Glavins and the Maddoxes and the Smoltzes and the Pedros and the Randy Johnsons, just guys who were almost like once-in-a-generation type pitchers. But Schilling is pretty darn good in his own right, and is good and, or better in the postseason than all those guys. And I think as the voting population gets younger and smarter, and they look at some of the some of the more relevant new age statistics that are out there, Schilling comes up big in all of those. Just, you know, he doesn't have the gaudy win total, but you know, wins become less important as you look more into the numbers. And Schilling was certainly a strike machine, a big game pitcher, and certainly everything you'd want on a pitcher. The only thing really lacking on his resume was a Cy Young, but he finished second 3 or 4 times, I think. And just going against Randy Johnson and Pedro and guys like that in that generation kind of hurt him in that department. But yeah, I think that Schilling will get into the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, 3-time Cy Young runner-up. I think what hurts him sometimes is that he was rarely the best pitcher on his team, but that's right. Not necessarily his fault when you're talking about Randy Johnson and Pedro Martinez, two guys who went into the Hall of Fame on the first ballot. I mean, it's tough to be better than that guy, but Schilling certainly has those moments. I feel like that's what ends up carrying him over is the bloody sock, the title with the Diamondbacks, beating the Yankees, and then to go to Boston and break that long drought and to break the curse. Those are the things that I think eventually, as time goes by, stand out more and more as historic moments, and those are the things that some players who are on the cusp don't necessarily have.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Schilling at his best was utterly dominant. I mean, would you rather have Curt Schilling or Don Sutton? You know what I mean? And not to diminish Don Sutton, but here's a guy who's in the Hall of Fame because he accumulated a lot of wins. I don't think that anybody saw them both of them at the height of their games. Probably any one of them would probably tell you that Curt Schilling was the more dominant pitcher out of the two. And isn't that what it's about? It's being sort of the best of the best. So I think that, you have the bloody sock. And even in Philadelphia, he won some huge games in that 93 playoff run. And, of course, Arizona, they don't win that World Series without both Schilling and Randy Johnson. Two of them really fed off each other that year. So, yeah, I do think that, Schilling is going to get it. It's just going to take a couple more years.
Nomar Garciaparra also on the ballot. He's a guy who was on for the first time a year ago. He got 5.5%, so he was able to stay on the ballot. It seems like that may not be the case this year. Nomar is a guy that it seems like when you look back to his years in Boston, he was headed for a Hall of Fame career early on. But then the injuries caught up with him a little bit. He ended up, you know, leaving the team, getting traded, of course, in the 2004 season. And he didn't quite finish his career the way a Hall of Famer finishes a career.
Yeah, like you said, Nomar was really on a Hall of Fame track. I mean, people, his first 4 years in Boston were just crazy. I mean, people were comparing him to Ted Williams, saying that he was going to be the best Red Sox player, best Red Sox hitter since Ted Williams. He was also tremendous defensively back in those days and could run. But, yeah, injuries really took their toll after about 2003. He really never came close to being that kind of player again. He had one kind of throwback year in Los Angeles where he made the All-Star team, but yeah, injuries really betrayed this guy and took away what would have been a Hall of Fame career. So almost, in a way, like a poor man's Don Mattingly. I don't think he had quite the career that Mattingly did, but the same type of thing where, he looked like he was on his way to being a Hall of Famer and just, lack of health really, really hurt him. But yeah, Red Sox fans will never forget how good he was and how popular he was in those early years. Just not quite enough for a Hall of Fame career, though.
Now we're getting to the point in the hot stove season where things are quieting down a little bit. The Blue Jays have done most of their work already. So, what's left on the shopping list as far as Toronto goes?
Yeah, it's mostly kind of depth options at this point. I think for the most part, they feel like a lot of the heavy lifting has been done with some of the moves that they made early on, bringing in guys like Jesse Chavez and Jay Happ. I think what they're looking for now is more kind of those depth options, both in the bullpen and in the starting rotation. So obviously they're going to continue trying to look to add to the minor league depth as well, because that's something that was really lacking at the upper level. So I think in the coming weeks you'll see probably more guys signed to minor league deals, some more guys brought into camp to try and compete for jobs. But unless something changes, it doesn't seem like they're going to make another big splash with some of the guys who are still out there on the open market.
You mentioned those minor league deals, and since we last spoke, they've brought in Roberto Hernandez on a minor league deal, Brad Penny on a minor league deal. Both those guys will be invited to spring training. And those are guys, Roberto Hernandez, obviously once known as Fausto Carmona, but those are name guys that people have heard of. The question, I guess, is how much is left in the tank for each of those guys?
Yeah, exactly. And I think it would be surprising if Brad Penny will be someone who's going to start in the minors. Roberto Hernandez has an outside shot at coming in and competing for that fifth starter job, against guys like Jesse Chavez, Drew Hutchison. But he'd have to really impress during spring training, I think, in order to do that. I think more than likely you're looking at a situation where he starts the year in AAA Buffalo. And, he probably would be one of the first guys, as things stand right now, that would get an opportunity if there was kind of an injury. The Jays do have the extra starter, whoever misses out between Chavez and Hutchison. But after that, there wasn't really a lot of depth at all. And they're looking to add some guys that they think can come up at some point during the year and fill in. Because as we know, teams never get through a year with just five starters. There's a need for more than that. And I think that's what they're looking for from Hernandez.
Yeah, and he's a guy who's shown that in a spot start situation, he can really be effective. I don't think he's a guy you would want to lean on every fifth day, but certainly he can come up if they need him and be a contributing guy within that rotation. Another guy that the club brought in, Arnold Leon, they get from the A's for cash. He made his major league debut in 2015, didn't pitch a lot, 19 appearances, had a 4.39 ERA for Oakland. Does he have a chance to make this bullpen, or is he a guy who's probably going to end up in the minors as well?
He has an outside chance. I think he's probably someone that would come in the minors again, but he is someone who made his major league debut in 2015, around 27 years old. He's a guy who has the ability to come in and compete for that job. I think something the Jays like with him as well is the versatility that he offers. He's someone who really kind of transitioned to more of a full-time starting role after 2013, and he's really had a lot of starts over the last little bit. So the fact that they can look at him both in the bullpen or as more minor league starting pitching depth, these are just the type of guys that the Jays are looking to add right now. And those are probably some of the similar type names are the ones that they're going to look to add in the future as well. They're trying to kind of build as much depth as they possibly can.
Gregor, you have an article on BlueJays.com right now talking about players on this roster without options remaining on their contracts who are going to have to clear waivers at some point, and we'll see how that goes. But five of them kind of stand out that you focus on in the article. I wanted to go through them quickly. Ezekiel Carrera seems like he's a guy that is only really going to have a spot on this team if the team was able to trade another outfielder, right?
Yeah, exactly. And that's, to me, one of the surprising things about this Jays offseason is that so far they've hung on to both Ben Revere and Michael Saunders, and it doesn't really seem like there's been a lot of traction either from the team itself or from other teams in terms of rumors that have been out there. But going with those two guys does tie up quite a bit of money in left field, but what it also does is it's going to tie up that bench spot as well. So, as things stand right now, you look at Ben Revere as the starter in left, Michael Saunders would then become your fourth outfielder, pinch hitter off the bench, and someone who would probably get some starts against righties as well. And that leaves Ezekiel Carrera without a job. If the Jays were looking to make a move at some point in time, he's someone who could be the fourth outfielder. But as of right now, he's on the outside looking in.
Now, Junior Lake, similar situation. Does he have a better or worse chance than Carrera?
It's probably about the same. I mean, he's coming in. I think there's a familiarity factor with Carrera, the fact that he did quite well for the Jays in that limited role in 2015. So you probably have to give him a bit of a slight edge. But, you know, Lake's another guy who would be in a pretty much similar situation that you know, he needs another move to be made out there in order to be able to like be considered an actual candidate during spring training.
Steve Delabar was an all-star just 2 years ago, but things have kind of fallen off a little bit for him. What has been the problem? And when you look at him on the mound and his stuff, could he re-find what made him so good a couple of years ago?
Well, it's a really interesting case, and he's going to be someone to watch for sure in spring training. And you know, it's been a little bit mysterious, and it's, you know, in some cases it's, you know, something that happens across baseball all the time is those bullpen arms. You sometimes see them come and go. You know, the guys who are able to find that consistent success year in and year out are very hard to come by. And Delabar certainly has the potential. What he's run into problem-wise in the past couple of years has been command first and foremost. He's also not missing as many bats as he did before. The strikeout rate has gone down. He's always had a little bit of a tendency to run into a problem with the home run, and that's been an issue as well. But it's really been consistency from outing to outing. We've seen glimpses of what he's been able to do in flashbacks back to 2013. But for the most part, that consistency hasn't been there, and he's really going to have to prove something in spring training in order to lock down one of those final spots in the bullpen.
And then the last two guys that you mentioned in the article, Chad Jenkins, another pitcher, and then A.J. Jimenez, who really, as far as catching goes, it seems like this team is set.
Yeah, absolutely. And from a Jays perspective, that's a bit disappointing, too, because A.J. Jimenez, you know, was once one of this club's top prospects, and he's really kind of seen his stock fade over the last several years now, and it's just because there has been a complete inability to stay healthy. And, you know, it seems like every season that he's had, his development has been slowed because of an injury that has kept him out for a pretty extended period of time. And the bat just hasn't been able to develop because of that. He's always been known as a very good defensive catcher, but the repetition just hasn't been there over the last few years. And originally he was someone who you were probably going to look at as at least breaking into the major leagues as a backup catcher. But right now Jays have you know, Russell Martin and Josh Tolley. They need Tolley for Dickey, so it doesn't seem, unless there's an injury, that A.J. Jimenez has much of a shot during spring training.
So obviously the Rays didn't have a lot to do overall this hot stove season. They made some moves early on as well. So as we turn the calendar over and start to look ahead to spring training, which scary is a little over a month away before pitchers and catchers are going to be reporting down in Florida, is there anything left for this team to do when you look at this roster?
I really don't think they have any pressing needs. It doesn't mean they wouldn't want to do something to enhance what they have, though, because I do think they have a lot of depth, and I think a lot of that depth was created last year by actually having the injuries they had and allowing some of the players to play who would not normally have gotten the opportunity.
We're getting to that point in the off season where players that don't have teams maybe start to get a little bit nervous, and maybe the later you get, you can find deals, find discounts on players. Is that something the Rays keep an eye on to maybe get a player they didn't think they'd have a chance at back in November or December, but maybe falls into their price range now?
I think they're always looking at that. I kind of think it's like a game of musical chairs at this point of the season. You know, once the chairs start to disappear, you know, some of these guys are faced with the reality that, you know, A, you might even have to sign a minor league deal, and, you know, with an invite to spring training, which is what the Rays have done a lot with some of the veteran relief pitchers, or you might get that veteran slugger who maybe had a down year and needs 1 year, you know, a 1 year deal to kind of bring himself back in the focus and, you know, maybe get him for a little better price than what they normally would.
Most of the talk as far as the Rays go and possible trades this offseason has been about obviously the starting pitching because they have so much depth. We had heard some talk about conversations with the Dodgers. Now the Dodgers seem like they've filled that need. Now that we're into January, more and more confident that the starters the Rays have right now are all going to stay put in Tampa Bay for at least the beginning of 2016?
It looks that way. You know, I think probably nothing happened because I think the Rays were in a good position by not having to make a deal. And when you don't have to make a deal, you can drive a harder bargain for some of the players you have. So I think they're very comfortable having, you know, a big group of starters, particularly based on how thin they got last year. So I wouldn't be surprised either way, really, to tell you the truth. But I do think if they moved one of their top starters, it would have to be a pretty good deal.
You have an article up on the site right now about Kurt Casale and what a great year he had in 2015, basically. And really the back behind it is the fact that he kind of changed his approach at the plate. Talk about that a little bit and his thoughts on that as he heads to 2016.
Well, it's funny, really, that one of the only other guys I've ever seen do this was actually Ben Zobrist. When Ben Zobrist came up with the team after the Rays traded to Houston for him, he was kind of a ping-ping to all fields type guy, and Ben is a big guy. Casale's a big guy, a bigger guy. So, you know, I think somebody got it into his mind, you know, why don't you get up there and finally take a rip at it? And he did that, and he had some success getting some home runs. So now, having changed that approach, he feels good going into the off, you know, felt good going into his off season to kind of try and build on what he did last year with that new approach.
And it seems like, you know, the strikeout is a more and more acceptable thing. So for a catcher, where I think most teams would rather get some more pop from their catcher than a high batting average, it makes total sense, even if you're going to strike out a little more. If you can hit 15 home runs from that catcher spot, that's a huge lift for any team.
Oh, no doubt. And it should be pointed out, his defense continues to get better as well. So, and he's a smart guy, a Vanderbilt guy. Pitchers like pitching to him. He has a good baseball acumen, so I think heading into the season, he's going to be your number one guy, although I still think you're going to see a lot of Rivera, and I don't know exactly how they're going to do Hank Conger yet, how much he's going to get behind the plate. I think they're kind of figuring – I think they can work with him behind the plate a little bit in some of his throwing problems, but he has certainly had good enough offense to where, you know, we might see the team keep three catchers this year.
And that's a good spot to be in. Is there a point where maybe they can use one of those catchers, maybe if it's at the trade deadline, if they need to do something, move one of those catchers to help out another area or spot of the roster? Or do you think they're happy because those guys can do different things?
Oh, I think that's definitely a possibility, and particularly in maybe Rivera's case, although he is the best defensive catcher of the group. So, and I do think they're kind of banking on maybe getting a rebound from what he did offensively last year. So kind of wait and see there. But I know they are excited about Casale's power potential.
We're into the new year, and it seems like when you look at years past with the Orioles and in the Dan Duquette era, at least, this seems to be the time where he really gets busy. January, February, he likes to do his work later in the off season. Is that fair to say?
I think so, and I think that this year, with the way the market has been slow to play in certain areas, that it's kind of the right strategy, at least for this season.
All right. Well, we have to – I think the place you have to start and end maybe with the Orioles is the continued saga of Chris Davis, and will he end up back in Baltimore? Although I'm not sure really how much has changed since we last talked back just after the winter meetings. It seems like it's just a waiting game here. So how long are the Orioles willing to wait to hear from Chris Davis?
I think that's really the big question now, and you kind of hit the nail on the head with the word saga, and that's really what it's been. I was told yesterday there's nothing new on anything regarding Chris Davis, and I think it really comes down to not the Orioles per se, but Davis and Davis's camp and what they're going to do. We haven't heard about any other teams with any interest. We haven't heard really about any other offers for Chris Davis. So I think the Orioles know they are the front runner. They may be his only suitor at this point in time. You know, I don't know, but it certainly looks that way as an outsider looking in. So it's going to really take Davis and Scott Boras to kind of take a hard look at what's going on and maybe say this is the best deal we're going to get. Now, the Orioles are looking at other options. They haven't really heavily pursued anybody, but I think the time is going to come here, sooner rather than later, that if there's still no movement on the Chris Davis front, they're going to be forced to move on.
Yeah, it's maybe helped the Orioles a little bit that the rest of the market, as far as outfielders go, has been so slow to develop. But now it sounds like Alex Gordon definitely heading back to the Kansas City Royals. So there's one guy off your board. You obviously still have some other talented guys out there with Cespedes and Upton. But how does Gordon signing and agreeing to go back to Kansas City, how does that affect this whole situation?
Well, I think it helps the Orioles because if you look at Gordon and the money that he took a discount to go back to Kansas City. And perhaps that's a signal that the market's a little bit softer for hitters than people realize. Well, maybe it goes to show that teams, after spending a lot of money before the calendar flip, are kind of done with those really expensive contracts. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with guys like Justin Upton and Cespedes and Dexter Fowler and the like. Because honestly, looking at Alex Gordon, and he was right in the mix with all of those premier outfielders available, the fact that he settled for a contract in the low 70s, and I know this is his hometown team, a city he likes playing for, organization he wanted to stay with, but it's still hard to fathom that Chris Davis would get anything close to the $200 million he's asking for, given the market and given what's kind of transpired here over the last day.
Yeah, Davis just a couple of years younger than Gordon, so you would think he won't get that much. Now, when you look at those other players, Cespedes, Upton, is there a chance the Orioles, you said they're you know, staying in touch with other players. Would they go with a big-ticket player if they can't get Davis, or are they more likely to spend less and go with a lesser big-name player?
I think they'd like to pursue, if they can't get Davis, a bigger-name player, someone to add power to that lineup, kind of balance things out. I really like Upton. I think he's a good fit. It's just unfortunate that the Orioles have such a weakness and such a big hole in terms of finding a left-handed hitter with pop, which is exactly what Chris Davis is. And getting Upton, you know, he's obviously not a left-handed hitter, and then that would be a big strike against them in their lineup, but they're still not ruling anything like that out.
Now, we're seeing more and more deals with opt-out clauses, and there seem to be popping up everywhere. It used to be the, you know, you barely ever see it. We saw Alex Rodriguez get one way back, but now more and more players are getting them. Scott Kazmir gets one after 1 year, but Dan Duquette's on the record as saying he's kind of against the opt-out clause in any of these deals. Is that something that at some point maybe he's going to have to revisit his thinking on that as these become more and more prevalent in the game?
I think so, and you know, they didn't feel confident offering Kazmir that kind of a deal, and there's a couple players they looked at that they just weren't confident with those kind of opt-outs, but I think the way things are going right now, it's turning more into that. So, sorry, that's my dog in the background. Well, I've tried to keep quiet for this podcast as best as I can. But, yeah, I think it's definitely something they're going to have to look at. And, again, they're hampered by their market.
What does the dog think of the Chris Davis situation?
Seriously, he's very excited about it, clearly.
All right, so they obviously still need pitching as well. When you look at that market, there's been talk that the O's have interest in Yovani Gallardo. How serious are those rumors?
You're talking about a guy who's been on their radar for quite some time. A guy who really they would love to have, they would love to add. And I think personally he's probably one of the better available starting pitchers, but I just don't know. I don't know if I see the Orioles actually doing that. I would really like for them to. I think that them missing out on Scott Kazmir was probably one of the better fitting free agents for them. But, again, I don't know what the money will involve, and the Orioles have been a little hesitant to offer some of these opt-outs and contract clauses that are happening.
Now, Gallardo has a pick attached to him. The Orioles, they could get two picks back, in theory, with Chen and Davis. Now, hopefully, they hope to get Davis back, so they wouldn't get that draft pick. But would that make them more likely to be willing to take on a guy who's going to cost them a first-round draft pick?
I don't know if it makes them more likely. I think that, you know, they'd obviously like to not lose the draft pick at all, but it's just a scenario where if they do end up having a guy and liking a guy at this point in time that's going to cause them to surrender one, so be it. They've definitely been an organization that has really, really emphasized the draft and trying to grow from within, because in order for them to compete as a mid-market team, they're going to have to hit on draft picks. They're going to have a really nice homegrown base. So I don't think it's necessarily a deal breaker, but it's just another reason why a guy like Scott Kazmir, I thought, a guy who didn't require them to surrender that draft pick, would have been a good move.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, it's early January, which also always means Hall of Fame announcement time. And the last few years, Mike Mussina has been on the ballot as far as the Hall of Fame goes. Hasn't gotten a lot of traction yet, although he's safely stayed on the ballot. He's a five-time All-Star, won 7 Gold Gloves, really had a great career starting in Baltimore before he went on to the New York Yankees. When you look at what Mike Mussina did, Brittany, do you feel like he's a guy who, the more years go by, he's going to kind of start to get close to that 75%?
I would hope so. I think he's expected to make a pretty big jump from last year to this year. He's a guy that people often overlook. So consistent, but never won a World Series, never won a Cy Young Award. A guy who I think eventually over time will continue to get closer to that 75% mark. I think people were projecting that he was going to jump up from 24% of the votes to well over 50, which is a big year-to-year jump. And just considering the era in which he pitched, how much emphasis was on these high-powered offenses, I think he's a guy who really deserves to get a look and obviously probably won't get in this year, but maybe over the course of the next few years, you'll see him really kind of state his case.